Our next speaker is Kurt Nock of Nock Vintage Records. Kurt is the chairman of the ARSC Dealers Committee and has been working on the ARSC grading project, which he hopes to have finished this year.
Good morning. Before I begin, I want to make two announcements. First of all, anybody who wants to buy any books, I'm going to be closing down my table and packing up after lunch. So, the other thing is, last conference in Washington, I prefaced my talk with a little bit about the status of the American Vintage Record Labelography before I gave my talk on the grading project today. I'd like to give you an update on the grading project before I talk about the American Vintage Record Labelography. Phase two, which I covered last September, has been completed. All the results are in and evaluated, and a full accounting of that phase will be found in the upcoming ARSC journal, which you should have very, very shortly. We have taken that information and made some revisions in the work that we've done in terms of the benchmark records we're using for the grading scale. I ought to have all of that material wrapped up, hopefully to be published in the ARSC grading monograph by the end of this year. Before I begin my talk, I want to ask you to reflect on a few simple questions. When was the last time you tried to dig up a piece of early discographical information, and what was it you were trying to find? If you were a librarian, perhaps someone asked you what vocalist recorded Take Me Out to the Ball Game. If you were a discographer, perhaps you were trying to find out what Benny Moten recorded during the summer of 1926. If you were a musicologist, you may have been looking for the earliest known recording of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. If you were a sociologist, perhaps you were looking for song titles relating to the Great Depression. If you were a dealer, perhaps you were trying to determine if your Jeanette test pressing of Judy Canova Doing Bird Calls was ever actually issued. If you are a collector, perhaps you want to know if your 92 Rudy Valley Victors comprise a complete set, or should you keep looking? If you were a lecturer at the ARSC Kansas City meeting, perhaps you were trying to print out a listing of lost Gregorian chant recordings on Pathé cylinders. As for me, I can tell you some of the things I've recently tried to find. Who is the conductor on CRS 10,000 entitled simply Symphonic Rehearsal? What is the song title on a Blind Lemon Jefferson Paramount that is so badly worn you can't even see the label? Is this record of Mengelberg conducting the Academic Festival Overture on Columbia the complete recording, or is there another disc to complete the set? How many Edison Diamond discs were issued? Most of us would know where to go to find the answers to these kinds of questions. Indeed, some of this information is readily available and can be found in virtually any public library. Other information, however, is much harder to come by and might require weeks of investigation to find. Of course, if the information you seek has never been published, you may spend a lifetime trying to find out your answer. Now imagine being able to insert a CD-ROM disk into your computer and within seconds query a database containing all known 78 RPM and cylinder recordings made in the United States. Well, such a resource is right around the corner. The American Vintage Record Labelography, or AVRL, as it has come to be known, is destined to become the most important instrument in the discographer's toolkit. And my purpose today is to describe this project to you, how it came about, where we are right now, and what the future holds. First, a little AVRL history. As a full-time record auctioneer, it is not uncommon for me to receive letters from collectors and discographers requesting further information about records listed in our catalogs. In most cases, the questions asked by any given bidder are limited to particular artists, musical genres, or labels. However, there was one individual who regularly submitted long lists of lot numbers, generally scattered among several different categories, and he always wanted full information, matrix numbers, take numbers, and composer credits. Though I didn't mind supplying him with the information he requested, my curiosity finally got the better of me, and I asked him just what he was doing with all of this information. He answered by saying that he had been working on completing discographies of the major labels since 1974, and the records he was asking about were filling holes in his database. When I asked him how far he had come, I was blown away by his response. Well over 100,000 entries had already been made, and several labels were complete, or nearly so. This intrepid discographer's name is Steve Abrams, and his vision of a comprehensive 78 RPM label discography will ultimately revolutionize our industry. I asked Steve what he planned on doing with his database, and I was similarly surprised by his answer. He really didn't know. His desire was to make the information available to record collectors and researchers, but he had no plans to publish his work. I asked him to send me a sample of his database, specifically his Jeanette file, since I had a number of Jeanette test pressings that were unidentified. When I got the disc, I loaded it onto my hard drive and was immediately able to determine the artists, song titles, and recording dates of the whole stack of test pressings, including the unreleased Judy Canova title. What a wonderful tool this was, to be able to search on a matrix number without having to page through a shelf full of books. I asked Steve if he would be willing to let me edit and publish his discography, and with his blessing and encouragement, the American Vintage Record Labelography was born. From the beginning, Steve and I wanted to publish a work that would be accepted and used not only by discographers and librarians, but would be equally suited for use by the collector. As much as possible, I wanted to emphasize the strengths and avoid the weaknesses found with existing discographies, whether they be artist-based, such as the bio discographies in the Record Collector, genre-based, such as Brian Rust's various volumes, or label-based, like the Rigler Deutsch Index. Furthermore, I recognize that an electronic discography would have an unusual set of limitations and possibilities, giving rise to issues that don't even exist in the print media. All of these factors would need to be taken into consideration. To this end, I put together a list of questions and circulated it among some of the world's premier discographers and vintage record authorities. These consultants were asked to freely exchange ideas, and an interesting postal discourse ensued for the next several months. Based on the comments and suggestions made by the participants, a preliminary database structure and data entry protocol was developed, and this material was recirculated among the participants. Once I had collected the feedback from the second round, a revised structure and protocol was mailed out for inspection. After gathering all the responses from the third mail out, a couple of final changes were made, and the project was officially launched. You may be interested to know who contributed to this year-long initial exchange of ideas. And I would ask that those individuals who I'm about to mention who are here today, if they would please stand briefly when I come to them. Steve Abrams, AVRL Principal Discographer, Frank Andrews, Author and Discographer, Stephen Barr, author, The Almost Complete 78 RPM Record Dating Guide, John Booth, editor, Talking Machine Review, Martin Bryan, editor, New Amberola Graphic, Sam Brolowski, archivist, Library of Congress. He's here, but I think he's at Charlie Parker's grave right now. Garrett Bowles, chair, ARSC Associated Audio Archives Committee. Garrett, are you here? Stand, please. Thank you. Tim Brooks, contributing editor, ARSC Journal. Tim. Dave Canfield, author, The Canfield Guide to Classical Recordings. Dave is here. Alan Debus, author, The Complete Entertainment Discography. Richard Green, archivist, National Library of Canada. Richard. Larry Holdridge, internationally known record auctioneer, Alan Kelly, author, his Master's Voice discographical series, Bill Klinger, compiler, the Cylinder Industry Survey. Bill is here. Bill Korst, discographer. Ross Laird, author, Tantalizing Tingles, a book which is up for an ARSC award. Reiner Lotz, author, the German National Discography. Larry Lustig, editor, the Record Collector. Bill Morin, author, the Encyclopedic Discography of Victor Recordings. John Mucci, director, GTE Viznet. Bob Pinson, curator, Country Music Foundation. Brian Rust, author, Jazz Records, 1897 to 1942, and other works. Mike Sherman, author, The Collector's Guide to Victor Recordings. Steve Smolian, chair, ARSC Technical Committee. Steve, are you here? Richard Spotswood, author, Ethnic Music on Records. Alan Sutton, author, The Directory of American Disc Record Brands and Manufacturers. And Ray Weil, author, Edison Disc Recordings. Thank you, Ray. 12 of these individuals were asked to serve in an official capacity on the AVRL advisory panel. Their selection for the panel was based not only on their intimate knowledge of discography, but also on their familiarity with computer technology. At this stage, the primary purpose of the advisory panel will be to authorize future changes in the established database structure and entry protocol, though minor modifications have been and will continue to be made as the database is fine-tuned, no significant changes will be implemented without first gaining a consensus among the panel members in support of the suggested modifications. As we worked on structuring the database, we never lost sight of some fundamental concerns. One of these concerns was accessibility. Not only discographers, but collectors, archivists, and the general public should have ready access to the information, and it should be simple, easy to understand, and user-friendly. Another important consideration was that the database had to incorporate the fundamental information making up any worthwhile discography, and that information had to be tied into a source. Also, the labelography had to be structured in such a way as to allow for future modification and expansion without the need to re-enter information. The database also needed to have a powerful search engine and a flexible report generator. Another key concern was the issue of data integrity. This is a tough one, and we recognize that the AVRL will never be error-free. But there are safeguards built into the system which should ultimately lead to a high degree of data reliability. Perhaps the biggest single concern for me personally was the issue of standardization. In my opinion, if rigid standards are not developed and religiously adhered to right from the beginning, the project is doomed to fail. Your handout shows a table structure we are currently using, along with the rules of data entry. I won't go into it in detail, but I would like to make a few salient points. Is there a marker I can use on an overhead projector in here? I forgot to ask earlier. Okay. If you'll turn to this page, I guess it's the first one, this describes to you what the database structure looks like. The first category of information, and the most important actually, is going to be the label, because that's what forms the basis for the entire labelography. Thank you, Gary. No, this is fine. So fields 1A, or 1 and 1A, are where the label would be entered. If you'll notice that on 1A, we have label subtype. We put this field in because some labels, take Victor for instance, use several blocks of numbers for various series. The Victor 3000 series was initially used for their first 10-inch recordings, and then later on was used for Red Seal recordings in the 1920s. So we needed to be able to separate those so that they wouldn't all sort together. Then we have a sortation field. The sortation field is actually more of an internal use for us, it enables us to be able to sort things like hit of the week records, which a computer would not be able to sort unless you did some specific programming for that. Then the catalog number fields are divided into three fields, making up prefix, number, and suffix. The number field is a numerical field, so only numbers can be entered into that. Things like leading zeros for certain vocalion race issues and things would be entered into the prefix field so that we wouldn't lose them. The matrix number is entered in the same way. You have a prefix, a number, and a suffix. Then you'll see coupling control number, which is used for certain other applications and which generally will not be a field that that most entries will have or that will have anything in. We have a field for issued takes. If a recording has six takes and 1, 2, and 3 were actually issued, those will appear here. We won't put six. If one of these takes was not issued but does exist as an actual test pressing today, then that would also be indicated. We have a field for album set number. And then we get into the rest of the information on the label. First of all, artists. Your artist field, we had a lot of discussion about this among the advisors initially, and that was, should the artist be entered last name first or as it appears on the label, or how that should actually be handled. And we finally decided that it should be entered exactly as it appears on the label. When you start entering things last name first, that requires a judgment call in many cases. For instance, if you enter, say, Bing Crosby on a DECA, that's pretty easy. But if you have a record that says Bix and Bing, then you're going to have to pick one artist to alphabetize by. And that's one thing that we've really tried to do in this whole project is to get away from the subjective. We don't want the person entering the information making decisions on his own, which are best left to a discographer. So we're not going to be able to sort alphabetically on the artist field, but we will be able to search for any kind of character string that you might want to ask about. The selection or title is the next field. Again, the title should be entered exactly as it appears, and if there is a subtitle in parentheses, and then it will be entered as such. The larger work is going to be something like the opera or the musical or the movie from which the song was taken, but only if that's indicated on the label or if it's inherently obvious. Anything, however, that's not on the label, whether it's obvious or not, if it isn't on the label, it cannot be entered into these fields without some kind of an indication that this is coming from a source other than the record itself. And that indication is brackets. Anytime brackets appear in one of these fields, that is additional information that's been put in there by the person in charge of that label or the one doing the entry. Then we have other fields, genre, subgenre, which are somewhat subjective, artistic credits, which are the composer, lyricist, transcriber, arranger type information, recording date, when known, recording location, matrix source. For instance, did this particular recording derive from Bridgeport Dye and Matrix matrices or whatever. Then we have record attributes. That would be something like 7-inch vertical, or maybe for a cylinder it could be 5-inch diameter, brown wax. We could put the speed in there when it's known and confirmed. Things that are assumed would be 10-inch and 78. Those would not be indicated. We have an authority field, which says where this information came from. Was the actual record itself examined? The record is our primary authority. That's, we ultimately want each of these entries to be confirmed by someone looking at an actual recording. But other sources might include a record company catalog or a discography or even an auction list. But we have various levels of authority, and something like an auction list or a handwritten sheet would be a very low level, and certainly something we would be trying to upgrade. Then we have a cross-reference field. If this particular matrix was issued on other labels, this is where that would be indicated. We have a comments field, which is pretty much wide open for anything that might be relevant. We have a field, which I'm calling here a status flag field, which is for internal use to tag items that may require further looking. And a contributor ID field, and this is a field where we have a code number assigned to the person doing that entry, so we can go back to him if we have a question. If that person is entering the information for a discographer, and we have a number of volunteers who receive information from discographers and are inputting it, then it would be indicated by his code followed by the actual discographer's code. So we know who entered the information, we know who provided the information. In spite of the work that Steve Abrams had accomplished, it was clear that he had only scratched the surface. There are two reasons that I say this. First, I make the statement based on what is not included. Most of the work that Steve had done centered on the major labels issued during the period between World War I and World War II, and these entries were pretty much limited to recordings of the jazz, pop, country, and blues genres. Classical, operatic, ethnic, children's, and specialty series were virtually untouched. Smaller labels were also largely incomplete or not even attempted. The second reason that Abrams only scratched the surface has to do with the nature of what is included. Though Steve was a pioneer in the application of personal computer technology to the field of discography, he struggled for years with the same types of severe limitations inherent in any kind of new technology. His biggest challenge was the severely restrictive limitations on field sizes that most early database programs imposed. This meant that most of the artist and song title information had to be abbreviated or truncated. Unfortunately, this is a problem we are still dealing with. The other problems associated with the Abrams data concern compatibility issues with our established AVRL table structure and entry protocol. In fact, most of the current entries in our database do not make use of all the available fields that we've established, and all of that is being worked on. All discographical entries in the database must eventually be standardized to reflect the AVRL rules. Since announcing the project a little over a year ago, I have done very little to further publicize the labelography. Contrary to what some might be thinking, this is not due to a flagging of interest on the part of the project participants. In order to explain what has been happening, let me back up a little bit. Sam Berlowski, who has been an advisor to the project from the very beginning, has long wanted to computerize the Library of Congress's 78 RPM holdings. This was not a library priority, however, so the requisite funding was not forthcoming. However, with the recent availability of the Abrams data, Sam was able to approach the library with a very attractive proposition. We would allow the library to use our existing database files for cataloging their collection in exchange for updated files when they were finished. This would save the library a great deal of time and effort in data entry, and it would profoundly benefit the AVRL by providing us with hundreds of thousands of additions and corrections. The hierarchy at the library consented to this arrangement, and work began exactly 1 year ago. Approximately 75 library employees volunteered to work 4 hours a week on the AVRL. These volunteers were divided up into three groups of 25, and each group was assigned a four-month rotation. So far, these volunteers have processed over 250,000 recordings, and it is estimated that the task will be completed within the next year. The way this was handled is truly remarkable. 25 computer stations were set up, and each computer was devoted to a particular label. This way, the volunteer in charge of the Bluebird label would work at the Bluebird computer and enter nothing but numerically sorted Bluebird records. It might be a good idea to point out that these volunteers are not unpaid college students or docents performing community service. Rather, these are trained library staff members who leave their normal jobs at the library for 4 hours a week to work on nothing but data entry. Once the library has completed their work, the first official edition of the AVRL will be released. It is our hope that other archives will wish to catalog their own vintage record holdings using the AVRL and thereby add to our database. As the labelography is passed from one institution to another, the total number of records being entered by each succeeding archive will be fewer and fewer. Richard Warren at Yale has already expressed an interest in taking the database once the library is finished with it, assuming that a team of data entry personnel can be put together. Certainly, if there is an institution represented here that would like to do the same, I am eager to talk to them. I would like you to turn to the page of your handout that shows the label listing. This is certainly not a complete list of all the labels that we've dealt with, but it is a list of labels that are actively being worked on by one person or another. Very many of these labels are complete or very nearly complete, at least as far as the popular output is concerned. I'm going to go through here and see if I can briefly tick off those that I know are complete. There are some on here that I'm sure are, but I didn't get a chance to go over everything in real great detail before I left on this trip. But anything that I tick off, I'm pretty sure we've got at least 90% of in the popular areas. Okay, some of these labels probably aren't even familiar to you because they're regional labels taken by volunteers in certain areas of the country. But we've got ARA, Banner, Berliner, Black Patty, Bluebird, Broadway, Brunswick, Cameo. I think we have the Cardinal Clarion Clear Tone issues. We've got Challenge Champion, Columbia, at least as far as the A series is concerned. We've got most of the brown wax, most of the cylinders, brown wax and later. We've got all the vivatonals and all the way up through the end of the Red Seal. Columbia's on 78. We've got all of these Columbia subsidiary type labels. Clarion, Diva, Harmony. I think we've got all Columbia Oxfords. We have all Columbia Silvertones and Velvetones. We've got Conquer. We've got Crown. I think we've got Domino. I've been working with Ray Weil on Edison. We have pretty much everything there except 2-Minute Wax. We've got, I know we've got all of Black Swan. We probably have some of these others. These Fletcher Company labels are put together by a guy in Europe. We've got Jeanette. I think we have most of the Grey Gull stuff, but I'm not sure. We've certainly got Hit of the Week. The International Record Company labels are being worked on, but we're certainly nowhere complete on that. That's going to be very difficult. We've got Jewel. We've got Lakeside. Same for the Leeds and Catton labels. Those are going to be tough. We've got Liberty Music Shop. We've got Little Wonder. And we probably have some of these smaller labels, but I don't recall. We've got Montgomery Ward. We have National Music Lovers, Newphonic, OK, Oriole, Paramount, Perfect. You'll notice that the really big labels are the ones that we really have the most on. I think we've got Puritan Triangle. We certainly have Record Guild. I think we've got Regal. We've got Romeo Royale. Superior. Talkaphone, Talkaphoto. Talking Book. U.S. Everlasting. Variety, Varsity. Victor. Of course, Victor's pretty big, but again, within the parameters that I described earlier, we have it. Vocalion, Voco, Vogue. Some of these things are so obscure, like 7-inch Wonder right here at the end. There's only one 7-inch Wonder record known to exist. We've got it. Okay. Right.
Also, in one of the issues of record research, Al Frank was still alive at that time and ran the International Record Agency, and so he put out his own label, Eragon. First two were derived from Jeanette, the rest were his own, and that was published in an issue of Record Research a zillion years ago.
Okay. Let me make a statement about what Ray said. He was basically relating two labels which he's aware of that I don't have up here. There are actually a lot of labels that have been compiled, which I don't have here. What I have here are the ones that are actually being input into the computer or have been input. There are a lot of things that we haven't yet had time or opportunity to tackle, but certainly those and others we will be getting to. Because of the scope of the library's participation and the monumental impact that it will have upon the AVRL, I have been somewhat reluctant to pursue discographical information and participation from other collectors. As long as two or more volunteers are working on the same label, there is a very real chance of losing valuable information or unnecessarily duplicating efforts. Therefore, the only volunteer efforts I have been encouraging are those concentrating in the following areas. Number one, cleaning up existing Abrams files. This consists of re-entering song and artist information in the format consistent with the AVRL protocol. We are also adding information to the Abrams files using original recording ledgers from various labels that have recently come into our possession. Number two, computerizing published label discographies. This ranges from small privately published discographies like Martin Bryan's Oxford Silvertone listing to the recently published discographies of Michel Rupli in France. It would be important to note that no discographies are being transcribed without the expressed cooperation and permission of the authors. Number three, research on minor or regional labels, especially post-war issues. And number four, Cylinder record listings and Ray Wiles Edison materials. Anyone wanting to help out in one of those four areas is asked to please talk to me. As I said earlier, once the library has finished their work, we will issue the first official edition of the AVRL. Hopefully, this will happen by the summer of 1997. In the meantime, however, we plan on issuing a prototype edition which will serve two purposes. One, it will show people what we have and what we need. And two, it will enable us to work with the database programmers, iron out a few bugs, and prepare a more useful product. In addition to the actual discography, the AVRL will include biographical information on the contributing discographers, information on the participating institutions, a detailed bibliography of discographical literature, a cross-reference table of pseudonyms, brief descriptions of the various labels and record companies, and more. Not all of these features will be included from the beginning, but our goal is to assemble a research tool which will be the primary source for anyone doing discographical research. The prototype version will only be available through me. It will probably not be advertised outside of ARSC, though anyone who wants a copy will be free to purchase it. Once the actual first edition is released, the CD-ROM will be made available for resale to dealers, book retailers, distributors, etc., just like any other published work. The initial cost will probably be around $100 to $200, and subsequent revisions will be available on a subscription basis at a reduced cost to first-time buyers. There is also a possibility that a special archival edition will be published that will cater more specifically to the needs of recording librarians. This may include features such as a MARC conversion utility and greater cataloging capabilities. I have been greatly encouraged by the amount of interest this project has generated, especially considering the limited publicity it has received. Our goal is to document every recording issued in the United States, plus as many unissued and special pressings as possible. Ultimately, we would like to see similar projects started in other countries, eventually resulting in an international vintage record labelography. Richard Green at the National Library of Canada has already begun the Canadian vintage record labelography, and I have also been in touch with interested discographers in England, Germany, and Norway. It is my firm belief that the American vintage record labelography is destined to become the most significant discographic achievement of the 20th century. And it is an achievement that all participating discographers, archivists, collectors, and institutions can be justifiably proud of, for without the cooperation of all of these groups, the AVRL would certainly not have been possible. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Why wouldn't you have the prefix or suffix fields of those, since many companies would issue,
Certainly, and prefixes are extremely important. And that is perhaps something that we could do. There will actually be, however, probably a separate table for album sets. The main database will contain it individually by record side, just like everything else. But that's not of great use to someone who's doing work on classical compositions. To have to look at one recording of Beethoven's Fifth and 6 or 12 entries or whatever it will be. So there will be a separate table which will be divided up like that, which will have album set, number, and title, and artist without breaking down the sides. Jerry?
How do you see the two related to one another?
Well, this is certainly a cataloging project. And it seems to include a great deal of the information that we specify in the Ars Cataloging rules.
Are the formats compatible?
They
seem to be different rules.
Well, this is really designed specifically for a database program. And the Ars Cataloging rules have no specifics as far as, field format, field specification, and so forth. Because it's really, the Ars Cataloging rules are intended as a more general set of guidelines, but this is certainly compatible.
The issue of what a librarian would use versus what a collector would use obviously is one that we really wrestled with and continue to a certain extent. There were certain concessions that we made in our table structure to enable this to be used by a library. And we have tried to make things relatively easy to convert into a format that a library is already using. One of the concessions that we made was having the titles given in all small letters, with the exception of the first word and the proper nouns. That's something that most collectors, when they first see, it will really bug them, because they're not used to seeing entries made in that way. But that is established library type procedure, and therefore it's much easier to convert your table to capitalizing the first letter of every word than to go the other way and try and reduce things to small letters and retain your proper names. So that's just one of those issues and examples where we try to find a compromise. Someone else? Yes.
Regarding the authority and the name issue, and you mentioned that there may be a possibility of a mark conversion utility later on, which would be very fine. I think this is a great tool. As a cataloger, I wonder, too, the application. I'm not bothered, but I just wonder, as far as putting a name as it appears on the label, as opposed to maybe
Like I said, we do have the capability built into the database rules that will enable you to put into brackets maybe a name authority or an accepted spelling or something. We will also ultimately have the pseudonym table, which will cross-reference the various entries in the database, so that if you would type in, well, if you typed in Vernon Dalhart, you get all kinds of stuff. But on the other hand, if you typed in Tchaikovsky, you would get various spellings. We felt, and this is something that Ross Laird, discographer in Hong Kong, was really very adamant about, and I was actually thinking more along the lines of a standardized thing, too. But what he said was that, really, it is the discographer's decision as to what material is important and what is not, and what should be changed and what should not. he, as a discographer, wants to know what the label says. He will make a decision as to how it should be spelled or what format it should appear in. I think that's very important because we're dealing here with a lot of information which is being input by people who really don't know. Even these people at the Library of Congress, they're used to things with pages. They're not used to hard pieces of shellac. And they see, Sam had an orientation session for these 75 individuals in May of 95, and he sat them down in an auditorium and he played them records and he played them, okay, this is a record, this is another record, sounds just like it, but this is a different take. And he had to describe to them what a take was and what a matrix was and all these various things that they really didn't know. And these are people who received some training. But they're going to enter, if we allow them to make decisions, then problems are going to creep in that we really don't want to have to go back and redo, especially because these entries are going to be marked as being taken from a record, which means that we're going to assume that that's correct. The record is our final authority. Yes?
Well, and I don't mean to cut you off on that point. I also, what sort of quality control with all these wonderful volunteers is happening to make sure of accuracy of inputting on what?
Okay, two or three different ways. First of all, every volunteer is assigned to a label coordinator, and theoretically that label coordinator is pretty well aware of what he's working on. Anybody who was inputting anything having to do with Edison, ultimately Ray would check it over. He's going to go through it line by line and make sure that everything is correct. We may not have that degree of quality control in every case, but that is what we're striving for. The problem is we're dealing with literally hundreds of thousands or millions of entries. You cannot hire or get people knowledgeable enough to do it right the first time in every case. You've got to rely on people who are willing to volunteer their time, because we could pool all of our resources, not come up with enough money to pay for something like this. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that as each succeeding archive goes through this list and they come up with a record that's already entered, they will check it against the existing entry. So that will continue to happen, and things will continue to be revised and updated. Dave?
In conjunction with this, if you're taking the name right off of the label of the record, I can think of one Victor 78 where Tetrazzini is misspelled as Tetrazzini.
Mm-hmm. Obvious label misspellings are different.
Are those going to be corrected where they're obvious?
Yes, yes. And because you'll find another later edition of that same record where they would have corrected the spelling. I mean, if there's an obvious typo, certainly that would be something. Yes, Steve?
I realize that you've established a hierarchy of sources of information, starting with the disc itself, discographies, and so forth and so on. There are obviously, from your list, some presently incomplete labels. Are you interested in having access to catalogs for the labels where you don't have complete information?
Yes, and we will be extremely interested in those catalogs once the library is finished doing what they're doing.
Is this a place to organize somebody or some way of reaching the people who have catalogs in the future to speed your project along?
I'm hoping that this will be considered among the discographical archival community as something worth pursuing in any way possible, so that when a person gets a CD-ROM disc and notices that they've got a full run of some label or a catalog of some label that we don't have, that they will step forward and say, we have this information if you would like to use it. As far as at this time, no, because I'm still want to let the library finish what they're doing. One thing that I really need, and this is because I have, my auction takes a tremendous amount of time and I've got a family and so many things going on, it's going to be very, very difficult for me to manage this as it's picking up. And what I'm looking for is a full-time editor, preferably someone who is retired and has a little bit of time. And I personally think Elwood McKee would be a tremendous person for this. And I've already talked to Elwood, and he has indicated that he may very well be interested in taking on that task. And if so, it would be in very, very capable hands. Anyone else? Just a minute. Jerry, you need to close. We're going to start a break. Anybody who has any questions at this stage, why don't you come forward, and I'll answer you individually. Thank you very much.
Okay, I just want to, before everyone gets up, I just want to repeat that if you'd like a ride to the airport tomorrow morning, you should go to the registration desk right now.